Jack Lott, Reel 5. So, Jack, what happened after El Alamein?
After El Alamein, we went by land across to Iraq, through Palestine, and landed up just short of Baghdad for a period. We did this by road, and to find the positions where we stayed through the journey, the quartermaster sergeants in their vehicles went ahead of the rest of the battalion. We were given back references of where we to halt for the night or whatever time it was, and then we had to give the positions of the companies when they arrived for where they were to go. And that's the way we got through to Iraq. We stayed Latafia, I think it was. A place called Latafia, where we camped for training. But we had leave or days available to go to Baghdad. It was in Baghdad that it was a film called Gone with the Wind. And I went across from the cinema to a stall that sold nuts. I bought some nuts. Whilst I was there, a big tall chap came and stood beside me. And I looked up and I said, "Oh, Wilf." Chap used to play in goalkeeper in the team I played for. Sat at home. And we had a little chat, of course. And there was a big hotel in Baghdad called Semiramis, and we spent a few nights in there. That was for sergeants and above only, I think. And eventually then we left. I don't think we did anything special in Iraq. We then, I think it was the port of Basra, that we went across to Chittagong.
What was Baghdad like while you were there?
Baghdad how can I explain it? A city of smells. it's quite pleasant. We never, of course, there was no trouble like there is today there when we were there. But some of them could speak English. I remember I was in the back of an 800 weight. Yeah, and a girl passed with all her yashmak on, etc., etc. She said, "Oh, Ginger." Someone that could speak English or some sort of English. But I can't remember much else about Baghdad. We didn't do a lot there. Well, I didn't anyway, but except, you know, make sure that everything was right for fit and fit for use, etc. Yeah, therefore, then we went on to Chittagong.
Did you know that you were going to India from Basra?
That I can't swear to. I don't know whether that came up en route or when we got there or what. I just don't know. I wouldn't like to say yes or no on that, because I might be wrong on either.
So how did you get across from...
We went by boat. We went on a boat called... God, I only thought about this a little longer. Empire Trooper. And on there I had a little job. Well, thankful for that, because he wanted something to do. I did anyway, and I wrote up a complete embarkation system for this boat. It was the system that was already in operation and I copied the system and wrote up all the embarkation cards and all this sort of thing. And for that, I worked with what they call the trooping officer on this boat. I had a nice office on A deck, and A deck was for lieutenant colonels and above, and one colour sergeant. And that was very pleasant. And they used to supply me with tea and biscuits and sweets and all sorts of things. I had quite a grand time.
Can you tell me how that embarkation plan worked then?
Well, the embarkation worked, as far as I can remember, that each person on to be shipped on this boat was given a card. And that card had been sorted out and was the actual deck he would be on, whether he'd be in a cabin or whatever, all the detail of food and supplies and bar and everything else. Everything was on there for anybody to study and be able to operate.
Did you enjoy doing that sort
of
work?
Oh yes, I did, yeah. And of course the trooping officer, he was quite a lad. He used to come round on sort of deck inspections and stand to who's on, you know, for a boat drill and so on. And he always seemed to look out for me, and then he'd lean over and say, "It's too loose, tighten up." And yes, it was good, I enjoyed that.
What's the role of a trooping officer?
Basically, the looking after the troops on board, their living conditions and eating conditions and everything that's relevant to troops.
Would he be attached to that ship, or would he?
Yes,
be
that ship.
So he's not. Would he not be from one of the units that was travelling on the ship?
Or no, I don't think so. No, I think he's a Navy man. Mm.
So what was conditions were good for you? What about the rest of the battalion? What were conditions like on board for them?
Much about the same as Laconia. It was pretty awful, really, because all they had was hammocks and that sort of thing. They had no real room or anywhere to live in, as it were. And drinks were about the same. Really, what any trooping ship would be like. You know, it's very difficult. But I was well off.
How long did the voyage take?
Several weeks, I think it was. Yeah, it must have been, because I couldn't have done the job with them in a few days.
So where did you end up?
Sorry?
Where did you end up?
Went to Chittagong and then into the Arakan.
So you went from Basra down to straight to Chittagong?
Yeah. Mm.
Okay, so when you arrived at Chittagong, what happened there when you disembarked?
This is where we... we went to... Oh, crikey. Buthidong. It's got me beat.
So you'd arrived in the Arakan. What happened?
We did this to Nagidok Pass and places like that. And then we came out. I think we were flown out from there into Dimapur.
When you'd arrived in the Arakan, what were your impressions, though, of the terrain there? Because it must have been completely different from what you've been used to, because you've been in desert for the last
years. Yeah, it was jungle. It's relatively flat, but when you got up towards the tunnel area, then of course there's more features there. But we didn't get very far up there, as far as I was concerned, so it's a bit of a job for me to say a lot about that.
What about your job, though? Your job must have changed slightly as you'd arrived in the Arakan. Was there a different way of...
Well, this is when we started with the mules. Because we did move mules from that area into Dimapur by air. I think it was one of the first times it had ever been done.
So did you use mules to move your stuff?
Yeah, mules from the Arakan into Dimapur.
So had you had any training with these mules?
Not a lot.
Did you have a mule that carried your stuff for the company, or did you have a number of mules?
The mules that we carried, that we used, were basically for rations, for food. All equipment was carried by the individual and by the platoons and so on. We didn't use any mules for the equipment as such. If we did, they were the large, I think they call them E-type mule, that could carry mortars or could carry, you know, light artillery. But if we had any of those, it was very, very few.
So with the mules, how did you take to working with mules?
It was, well, we had a muleteer company, and they did a lot of training on mules. How can I put this? And also we had Indian muleteers that also came over to the battalion to work with us. But they were used more when we got after Kohima. We used mules then more than, because when we arrived in Dimapur, we didn't move out of there until we moved into Kohima. And I can remember we arrived and we were put into a camp, which was quite reasonable. And there we had a visit from Vera Lynn.
Was this at Dimapur?
Yeah, before we moved up. And then we had cinemas. It was one night at the cinema that I was called back out of the cinema for an O group to move to Kohima the next day. And we did move, I think it was about the 3rd or 4th of April. And we got to Dimapur, and we were situated on the a spur where the general hospital was. And the next day we were told to go back to Dimapur.
How had you got up between Dimapur and Kohima?
By road.
What was the road like?
Very, very steep, hilly, terrific bends, long drops down the side. Very dangerous road.
Who were the drivers?
Our own drivers as well. And then the next day we were sent back. And the day after that, we sent back up again.
With the same procedure again, your own drivers. Yeah. How long did it take to get between Dimapur and Kohima, just roughly?
Half a day, I think. Something like that.
So the distance isn't that vast then over that territory?
No. Because that's what they were worried about, that if the Japs got through Kohima, they would have taken Dimapur and India, they reckon.
And what were things like in Dimapur before you went up?
We didn't see Dimapur very much. We transferred from the aircraft to this camp area. I don't remember seeing a town or anything like that. It must have been. Because the bishop of Dimapur was involved in the cathedral at Kohima. So there must have been something there.
Because I'd always been led to believe it was just a stores depot, almost by the side of the railway. There was very little else
there.
So you moved up to Kohima that second time.
Yeah.
Can you take me through what happened?
What happened then? We then debussed, if you like to call it that, with the lorries, and unloaded the lorries, and then we moved up the hill onto Kohima Ridge and FSD Ridge and so on that day, leaving some of the stores to be picked up eventually or later. But once you're off the lorries, you had to get off the road. Now, this trip going up, I don't know how the Hindu or Indians were there with a sped, you know, a sped that carried ammunition. I think there was a little a gun up in Kohima before we arrived, so it must have been from that. But we were going running the course along this road, which was under view, possibly for the Japanese, and this sped was halfway across the road, and I got out of my vehicle and said to the Hindu chappy to get it shifted, and they more or less refused to move it. So I said, well, if you don't, I'm afraid I'll have to shoot you. And I pulled out my revolver, and they eventually pushed it aside. But we were absolutely open to anything. And that was the first incident. But I don't know what he was doing there, but I had to shift him.
Had you come under Japanese fire on your move up the road?
Not at that stage. We come under fire a little bit afterwards. But I could have come under serious fire if they had spotted us there. I don't know.
What do you think do you think he was frightened that the Japanese were there? Or?
Possibly. And I wasn't worried about that. I was worried about shifting.
Were you carrying the stores in the back of the vehicle?
Yes, we were. We were carrying the cooking utensils and things that we really wanted. We were carrying eight packages of water. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. And I mean, that packages probably was that long, about that wide.
About two foot by a foot.
No, not quite a foot, about that. And we got those, unloaded them. We got our cooking utensils up the hill to our position. We put these cooking utensils in a communication trench, and we were in a dugout near it. Round the corner was the Company HQ, the Pioneers around the other side, and then of course the Maltas were out in the position.
How had you known where to go when you pulled up at Kohima?
We were told, someone was there to tell us where to go. Because Palsy, he was something to do with the town. Anyway, somebody was there to chat us about. We arrived there and gave the chaps a cup of tea, etc., etc. I can't remember doing any cooking at that particular stage. And then we viewed the situation. We were overlooking, we were above the DC's bungalow, you heard about that. And we were actually what they call the second line of defence. DC's bungalow, that had a lot of action. Major Winston, he was the first lot, I think, then Major Eason. I mean, they were fighting the Japanese across the tennis court. And they were attacked an awful lot, by day and by night. But after about a day, I suppose, we suffered continual shelling all day long, and mainly under open sights. You hear the bang of the gun, the bang of the shell at the same time. So it was very difficult. But earlier on, soon after we got there, I did a reconnoitre with it, because it was fairly quiet then. And I knew we were short of rations, so I'll see what I can find. And on the FSD ridge, I found the supply depot. And in there was I found boxes of tomatoes and pineapple. So I pinched a few off, or several of them, and brought them along to the top of the hill we was on, and they had to remain there for that particular time. And then shelling started, but when we arrived, the hill was all covered with foliage, so we couldn't see a thing. But after about a couple of days or so, nothing was there. It's all blown away, the shell. So therefore, it's very difficult to move. About every couple of, I think about every 2 days, I used to take a chance and run the gauntlet up the hill to these rations that I got and dished out a few tins to each platoon, you know, give them something different, because water, we got water when we arrived there, but I think it was about after a couple of days we got cut off from water. And then we wanted something to put the water in. So I said, well, at the bottom of the hill, where we unloaded, there are six or seven packers. I said we could get those. So I went to my favourite platoon and got some fatigue party, which the pioneers, and we went down. It was a dead of night. Roughly, I think about 2 o'clock in the morning. We had no idea where the Japanese were, but we had to get these packers. When we got down to the road, and we had to go through some troops that were already there, like Punjabis and so on, and told them we were coming back. When we got to the road was about 8 foot below the surface of the hill. So number one, we had to get down there. Number two, I had to get some cover. So I split the pioneer platoon up, some to stay on the top and cover us, and the rest of us to go down and get to the packers. Well, we got to the packers, all right. And then I suddenly realised, well, I got hold of them full of water. Impossible to carry them back up the hill. So you can imagine, dead of night, didn't know where they were, to empty seven packers of water and the noise it makes. Be surprised they wouldn't. Anyway, we did it, and obviously we got back. And then I gave the packers to the area where they wanted them to, and I had no more to do with them from then on. But we did get supplied, general supplies of water. We got some supplied by air as well, but that was used by the troops because we were only allowed half mug of water per day, and that was for everything. You weren't allowed to wash or shave. I grew a lovely ginger beard, and that's the way I was involved. I was not involved in any hand-to-hand stuff. I was involved simply with another thing I really can't remember. I can't remember. I've racked my brains, and I've asked people what we did as far as cooking was concerned. We must have done some. But, you know, I cannot remember that whatsoever.
You mentioned you were getting your stores from up the hill, from the stores. Where had those stores originally come from? Were they for the town, or were they...
They were from a supply depot on the hill, FSD Ridge. That's where I got them from.
And you would say you would take a chance to get up there. How would you move?
Well, I had to go up. When I went up different times of every day of the day and took a different route every day, because at that particular time they were able to see, and they did use sniper fire. And, that's that chance I had to take. And I got away with it, that's all. So basically that was my time in Kohima. One other thing that happened, I was in a dugout, and we wanted to make the aperture of the dugout a bit smaller, so I managed to find some old biscuit tins, filled them with earth and put them in the aperture, and then sort of stepping into the dugout, which, by the way, held grenades, and we had to sleep on them. Walking on it made indentations. And I was looking over the parapet of the dugout, looking to see what was going on, and I couldn't see anything. But all of a sudden I heard a rattle. And I looked down at these tins, and there was a bullet spinning around in the indentation. So obviously I must have been under sniper fire. And we didn't do that again. And,
when you went down to get the water containers, were there wreck vehicles on that part of the road at all?
No, we unloaded all the goods and they were sent back to Dimper.
So they were never caught?
They were never caught.
Under fire?
No.
And at the time you were there, obviously you were on part of the hillside. Were you in recognisable companies, or I know you mentioned the Pioneers were in and Headquarters Company, but were the companies all mixed together at that stage?
No, they were in different areas. Like there was Cookie Pickett, there was FSD Ridge, there were several other features where the companies were situated, where the tax came in, and the DC's bungalow. That was attacked quite often. But also, whilst we were there, I've never witnessed anything like this before. I've been under a few barrages in the desert. I was in the big barrage there when 100 guns opened up, I think it was. But I don't know how many days it was into the battle, but an artillery officer got through. And he came as an OP to see what he could do. He got through to us. And from the battalion headquarters, I think it was, he ranged the guns who were in an area way back from us, about several miles back down the road, and with the 2nd Division. And he ranged the guns, which was a marvellous feat. He ranged so the guns fired and they came over the hill and dropped the other side of the tennis court where the Japs were. Not the side where we were, where B Company were that side, but on the other side. And they're absolutely marvellous gunnery.
That didn't occur right at the start then of the siege?
No, that was halfway through. Several days through.
When did the air supply start, or the airdrops occur?
Several days, I think, before they started. They started dropping water to us, and they started dropping water ammunition, 3-inch water, and some food, I think. And a lot of the ammunition dropped on the Japs, but we were fortunate enough to get some water, which the water basically we used for half a glass a day. And
what physical condition were you in after? What physical condition were you in after several days of this?
Well, being continually shelled, it was pretty awful. I remember it was either once or twice I did get out of the trench to go up and I was blown back in again. But I wasn't hurt. I was extremely lucky everywhere I went.
How accurate was the Japanese shell fire?
Japanese shell fire was, well, it was open sight, so it was one feature straight into another. There's no sort of actual ranging of the guns. It was straight in.
When the British gunnery officer arrived and ordered, you know, the gun support for yourselves, did that happen?